This is Dr. Robin Nasheb, Director of Education at the Prime Center, and I will be hosting our monthly pain call entitled Spotlight on Pain Management. Today's session is Caring for Veterans Reporting Chronic Pain, Provider Experiences, and Trends in the Prevalence of Chronic Pain. I would like to introduce our presenters for today, Drs. Evan Carey and Chelsea Leonard. Dr. Carey is a statistician and data scientist for the Denver-Seattle COIN, and assistant professor at St. Louis University Center for Health Outcomes Research. Dr. Leonard is a biological anthropologist with broad ethnographic and laboratory experience. Her interests are in public health and adapting ethnographic methods to healthcare research. We will be holding questions for the end of the talk. If anyone is interested in downloading the slides from today, please go to the reminder email you received this morning, and you will be able to find the link to the presentation. Immediately following today's session, you will receive a very brief feedback form. Please complete this as it is critically important to help us provide you with great programming. Dr. Bob Kearns will also be on the call today, and he was involved in the project that you'll hear about and will be able to answer questions as well. And now I'm going to turn this over to our presenters, Drs. Evan Carey and Chelsea Leonard.
Thank you so much, Robin, for that introduction. We'll go ahead and jump right into it. So this is Evan Carey, and I'm actually a doctoral candidate, so not quite Dr. Carey yet, but in about a month I'll be there, I think. All right, so we're going to talk about caring for veterans reporting chronic pain. We're going to go through both provider experiences from a qualitative perspective as well as a quantitative project where we examine trends in the prevalence of chronic pain. Both of these projects are connected to the Triple AIM query, which is run out of the Denver Center of Innovation at the Denver VA. So the first project, Trends in Veterans Reporting Chronic Pain from 2008 to 2016, a national VA study. And I'll be presenting this project. So as most of you know on the call, of course, chronic pain is a leading public health issue in the VA as well as in the private sector. We have a commonly cited statistic based on the IOM report that affects up to 100 million people in the U.S. at a cost of $635 billion U.S. dollars. But I'm going to focus on a more recent published number that is directly relevant to veterans. Some other studies have found that veterans are at an increased risk of chronic pain compared with their non-veteran population. In particular, there's a study published last year by Dr. Nahin that showed that severe pain, veterans were at a 40% more likely to experience severe pain than non-veterans. That graphic below is from that study. A little bit more about that study. It was based on a national health interview survey data, about 67,000 adults, of which 6,000 or so self-identified as veterans. Using that survey data, they were able to estimate the prevalence of various chronic pain conditions, as well as persistent severe pain as well. There's a couple of interesting findings from that. It shows that generally veterans are at an increased risk of experiencing chronic pain, that there is an age correlation with chronic pain amongst veterans, veterans reporting severe pain, and that's that middle-aged veterans are more likely to experience pain than either younger or older veterans, which is an interesting finding. It's in contrast with the U.S. population, where we generally think of increasing age being associated with increasing chronic pain. A little bit more from that study, they found that female veterans were at an increased risk of reporting severe pain with respect to male veterans, and also in general at an increased risk with respect to the overall population, although I think they lack the study size to find that to be a statistically significant result. So there's a little bit of work that's been done estimating the prevalence of chronic pain or severe pain or persistent pain in the U.S. population and in the veteran population. However, there's this public perception that chronic pain has been an increasing issue for both veterans and non-veterans. However, to my knowledge, there's no real national estimate of the prevalence or even the trends in the prevalence of chronic pain amongst all veterans engaged in care at the VA, which is arguably who we care about in the VA. Chronic pain is inherently subjective, and longitudinal patient-reported outcome collection across an entire population would be really logistically challenging. So we don't have good survey data that covers a long time span that would cover, you know, almost every veteran in chronic in primary care in the VA. So we think a feasible strategy is needed to try to understand chronic pain trends in the context of a changing veteran population. So really the big question for this work is, can we use the VA medical record, the electronic health record, to identify the prevalence of chronic pain amongst all veterans engaged in primary care at the VA? So more specifically, in this project, this first project, we seek to answer the following. Among U.S. veterans engaged in primary care at the VA between 2008 and 2016, what is the prevalence of chronic pain defined by both pain scores or conditions related to chronic pain, and is this prevalence increasing over time? Our hypothesis is that, indeed, it would be increasing over time some amount. The second part of this is to examine, is this observed change, assuming there is a change, in the prevalence of chronic pain explained by changes in the demographic composition of the underlying VA population? And our hypothesis is that, yes, that mostly the changes we see in the reports of chronic pain would be explained by changes in the underlying demographics of the VA. And then finally, we sought to examine if there were specific subsets of veterans that were at an increased risk of reporting chronic pain. And we hypothesized that, consistent with past studies outside the VA, that older veterans, female veterans, and non-white veterans would be at an increased risk of reporting chronic pain. All right, so the analytic approach is actually pretty straightforward from a statistical perspective, but we really, this is kind of a big data sort of project more than anything. So there's quite a number of challenges, but they had to do with the scope and size of the data rather than complex statistical analyses. So we first just identified all veterans engaged in primary care between 2008 and 2016. We next discretized time into year quarters. And this is between 2008 and 2016. So like 2008, January 1st, quarter one. 2008, April 1st would be quarter two and so forth. At the start of every one of these year quarters, we identify if the veterans at risk reported chronic pain in the current quarter or in the prior four quarters. Additionally, we identified other active chronic illnesses based on ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes in the prior four quarters or the current quarter. And then we identified pertinent demographic traits, age, race, and gender for each one of these veterans. And we did that for every quarter from 2008 to 2016 so that we could then estimate prevalence of these conditions and shifts in demographics. The data source for this was our typical VA administrative data. And so there's some details there. Essentially, it's our national CPRS system aggregated. We call it the Central Data Warehouse. It follows various business rules for data cleaning and so forth, and some more details about it there. I've done a bit of medication and studies connected to this as well. So for any of that, we got the PBM data as well. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the actual data definitions, though. How do we define active primary care? So, of course, in all of these metrics, we're mostly connecting utilization to these variables, right? So if somebody doesn't come in and get seen, we can't really assess if they're in pain or if they have diabetes and so forth. So we sought to identify veterans in active primary care such that we might expect to observe their healthcare activity. We define that as primary care visits in the 2 years prior to the start of any given quarter, and no reported date of death prior to the start of that quarter. If more than 2 years passed since their last primary care visit, we kicked them out of the cohort as no longer active in primary care. Then we calculated all the variables previously described at the start of each one of these quarters. As far as identifying chronic pain using administrative data, we identified chronic pain using both pain scores and chronic pain-related diagnoses. So for pain scores, we followed established literature. It would be moderate persistent pain is 3 or more pain scores at least 30 days apart, but no more than 1 year from start to finish. And those pain scores all had to be greater than or equal to 4. For severe persistent pain, the pain scores all had to be greater than or equal to 7. For the chronic pain-related diagnosis, we look for a couple of outpatient or a single inpatient ICD code in the current quarter or the four quarters prior. The statistic analyses were pretty straightforward. For the last piece of identifying whether or not the changes in prevalence were explained by shifts in demographics, we had to take a multivariate approach to estimating the prevalence ratios. So we used a quasi-Poisson general linear model for that effort. And the outcome was the chronic pain indicator as previously described. Then we fit two models. The first model includes just calendar time as a continuous predictor so that we can estimate the average change in prevalence over time. And the second model included calendar time as well as the pertinent veteran demographics. All right, so onto the first set of results. Using these methods, we identified a cohort of 9.2 million veterans with at least one primary care visit of some kind from 08 to 2016, and 8.1 million of them remained after a couple of different exclusion criteria that included missing demographics and some other data quality issues. We look at the distribution of this cohort over time. We can see about 4.5 million veterans were identified at the first time point in 2008, and it really steadily increased. And this is the at-risk population. And it increased up to about 5.5 million veterans by mid-2016. So our first question needs to be contextualized by how the actual changes of this population, so what are the actual changes in demographics and clinical comorbidities in this population over this time frame? So let's start by looking at the demographics. And as I think you would suspect if you've looked at some of the policy planning reports that report this sort of thing, what we've seen is, A, first, there's been a large increase in the number of veterans, again, 4.5 million up to 5.5 million. We're becoming increasingly non-male, right, from 94% down to 92%, increasingly non-white from 77% down to 74% across the time range. We look at the age distribution, we actually have to look at it. We can't just look at the average age, because really the mean age doesn't tell the full story of the changing age pyramid in the VA. So we split this by commonly used categories, and we see that our middle-aged veterans are actually becoming increasingly underrepresented across the distribution from 2008 to 2015. So veterans age 45 to 55 went down a bit. Veterans 55 to 65 went down quite a lot in terms of their representation in this time frame. And we picked up some younger veterans, and then clearly some of those middle-aged veterans aged into older categories. So demographics are not stable in this VA population, as you would expect. We next sought to examine other traditional chronic illnesses, comorbidities. We found that those were either stable or decreasing, right? So we think about what are common chronic illnesses that affect folks in the United States and also veterans. What we find in this cohort is that generally these things that might be considered common threats to public health, common chronic illnesses are all stable or decreasing even in the population. So we see cardiovascular disease from 4.1 down to 3.7%, diabetes 21%, pretty stagnant, heart failure 4 down a little bit to 3.8%, and really the same sort of story for every one of these chronic illnesses, generally stable or decreasing. However, when we look at mental health conditions, comorbidities that are often associated with complex chronic pain patients, they're generally increasing in this time frame. So again, from 2008 to 2015, we see increases in anxiety, bipolar disorder, depression, and TBI, and then some kind of stable in some of these other categories. So our mental health comorbidities are generally increasing in this time frame. It's going to lead us into our first AIM question. Among U.S. veterans engaged in primary care, what is the prevalence of chronic pain and how is it changing over time? So we first identified a series of conditions that are related to chronic pain, and they're almost all increasing. And this is in contrast to the other chronic illnesses that we examined a moment ago. Most notably, we see that back and neck pain has gone up from 12.8 to 17%, joint pain from 7.5 up to 10.5%, and some other things you can see there as well. Neuropathic pain has gone up. So a lot of the pain-related conditions are increasing over this time frame. Now, if we aggregate these chronic pain conditions up and we look at either pain scores, severe pain scores as previously described, or any one of those pain diagnoses, or any of the above, we can see that all of those aggregations are increasing over time. Notably, if we look at the diagnoses, by 2015, almost one in three veterans will have one of those pain diagnoses. For pain scores, one in five veterans will have a pain score, and one in 10 almost will have severe pain scores. So we did look at this for each individual quarter. So when we look at this over time in the VA, we can see that whether we look at the joint, you know, any diagnosis or pain score, diagnosis codes, moderate or severe pain scores, or just severe pain scores, the trend is similar. That's generally increasing. There's a bit of a flat spot in these mid-time points for the pain scores that I can't fully understand. I've talked to our leadership about this, and we haven't had a good explanation of why that would be yet. But in the diagnoses, we don't observe a similar flat spot in that time range. All right, so we observed a slight increase in chronic pain over time, but the question is there truly an increase, or do we really just see a shift according to demographics? All right, recall there are pretty substantial changes in demographics in the VA in this time frame, in particular changes in the age distribution, which is associated with chronic pain. So in order to estimate this, we did the quasi-Poisson modeling approach where we first got an estimate for the what we call the prevalence ratio. It's really just, if you take the risk, the prevalence of chronic pain in 2008 and 2015 and take the ratio, kind of estimating that construct as a linear function of time. So on average, how much has it changed? What we get is that compared with 2008, the prevalence of chronic pain in 2015 is 8.6% higher. And again, that's unadjusted for anything, just a function of time. After we adjusted for changes in demographics, which included our ages, shift, race, and gender, we actually found that the risk ratio went up. So it actually increased to 10.5%. So we would conclude there's a mild to moderate increase in the prevalence of chronic pain from 2008 to 2015 among veterans engaged in primary care. And furthermore, that increase is not due to changes in the underlying veteran demographics. Actually, once we condition on those changing demographics, it goes up a bit. All right, so some other piece, the last question we wanted to answer was, are specific subsets of veterans at an increased risk of reporting chronic pain? And we looked at demographics as done in prior work, including the work I referenced in the beginning, and we found very consistent results with what those survey results found. Now remember, this is a different population. That first referenced work was kind of the general sample of the U.S., some of which self-identify as veterans. This is the sub-cohort of veterans who actually come to the VA for care and receive primary care, right? So not all U.S. veterans do that, so this is a subset, but arguably it's the set we care about in the VA because it's who we take care of. And we found that female veterans are more likely to report chronic pain no matter which one of these definitions we use. We see kind of the same trend over time that's increasing a bit, but in all cases, females are more likely to report chronic pain either by pain scores, severe pain scores, or by diagnosis codes. When we look at race, what we find is, again, that non-white races are more likely to report chronic pain. The other category is quite small, so it's not a really stable estimate, but the other three categories are pretty stable. We find that non-white veterans are more likely to report chronic pain, and that's true whether we look at pain scores or patterns of diagnoses or severe pain scores. When we went and looked at the age distribution, we found a very similar result to what the survey results were that I presented in the background section, which is interesting because you would think that, again, we might have an increasing incidence of chronic pain with age or prevalence of chronic pain with age, but we don't really in the VA. We find that middle-aged veterans are at the highest risk of reporting chronic pain, and our youngest and our oldest veterans are at the lowest risk of reporting chronic pain. And I might have suspected this would be in part due to the fact that we're defining all these variables based on utilization, right? And they're perhaps older veterans are less likely to utilize the VA, or maybe they age out into Medicare or something like that. However, this is confirmed by that original survey study, which would not have suffered from that issue. So I do believe these results are accurate. All right, so to summarize, chronic pain prevalence is high among veterans in primary care at the VA. 1 in 5 veterans report persistent pain. 1 in 10 veterans report severe persistent pain. And 1 in 3 veterans have been diagnosed with one of those conditions related to chronic pain. The prevalence of chronic pain, no matter how you slice it, is increasing in the VA. And also mental health comorbidities, the prevalence of all of the mental health comorbidities that seem to, you know, be a part of a typical complex chronic pain patient that's a challenge to take care of, are increasing as well. In general, at the same time, the VA is becoming more female, more non-white, and our age distribution is shifting. However, those demographics do not explain the increase in the prevalence of chronic pain. And actually, once we condition on them, we see a slightly larger conditional increase. And then similar to some past findings, not surprising, we find female gender, non-white race, and middle-aged veterans are associated with the highest rates of chronic pain in the VA. And that's true whether we look at pain scores or related diagnosis codes. So I think there's some interesting implications for this work. The first thing that's astounding to me is the absolute number of veterans seeking care in the VA has increased substantially. And this is in the height of a you know, relatively full employment in the U.S. sector and so forth, and we still see more and more veterans seeking care from the VA. I expect that will continue. Interestingly, in this time frame, the number of actual U.S. veterans alive in the U.S. decreased, although we're seeing more and more veterans. And I think most important, these veterans are increasingly complex patients to care for. And these reasons that they are complex are somewhat unique and specific to the VA population. So we think about what types of veterans are challenging to care for and might have VA physicians are best equipped to take care of. We think of perhaps veterans with battle injuries or a lot of chronic pain conditions, mental health comorbidities, and so forth. And that is increasingly what we're seeing in the VA. And we're seeing stable or decreasing prevalence of other chronic illnesses. And this, of course, has direct implications for our community care providers. There's a lot of discussion right now in the VA about moving more care into the community for access reasons and whatnot. And I think as we consider that as an institution, we have to carefully think about what types of veterans community care providers are adequately equipped to give high-quality care to. And certainly this data would have us think that we might see even more increases if these trends hold in complex chronic pain veterans. And then finally, that these demographic shifts alone do not explain the increase in chronic pain amongst the VA patients. It's possible there's an awareness or diagnosis bias that is with this focus on opioids and non-opioid therapy, or even just getting veterans off of opioids, whether or not they're placed on other therapies, that we're seeing more and more attention paid to pain. So it could just be sort of a diagnosis bias. However, even if it is a diagnosis bias, I think we will still see resource demand shift according to these trends. Right? So whether these were currently, if there's no actual true increase in the prevalence, they were just underdiagnosed in the past, I think we'll still see a change in resource demand associated with those diagnoses. And of course, it's always possible that there is truly just an increase in the prevalence of chronic pain in this population. So some strengths and limitations of this study. This is, to my knowledge, the first national study where we use the full cohort of all veterans in the VA engaged in primary care covering such a large time range focused on chronic pain. This enabled us to, you know, precisely estimate to the best of the ability based on observational data the prevalence of chronic pain and other comorbid important conditions. However, one limitation, of course, that your strength is often your limitation, all this data was observational, right? So it's all based on utilization. If veterans don't come into the VA and we don't see them, we don't observe a pain score, we don't observe a diagnosis. So there's always that caveat to this sort of data. And we presume no chronic pain if there was no utilization. Now, that's probably an undercount of total chronic pain. However, it might be reasonable to presume that veterans that are in enough pain to seek medical attention, that that is certainly a threshold that could be crossed, in which case we do observe them in this VA. And we intentionally limited this to veterans in active primary care for the reasons previously discussed. All right, so we'll go ahead and switch now to the second project. Thank you for your time, but we'll I think hold for questions till the end, and I'll be around for questions.
Thank you, Evan. I will be reporting. Sorry, my name is Chelsea Leonard. I'm an anthropologist with the Denver-Seattle COIN, and today I'll be reporting on a qualitative study looking at barriers and facilitators to multimodal chronic pain care for veterans. I'll start off by giving you a little bit of background. Expert guidelines recommend multimodal chronic pain care that utilizes a full range of treatment options. By multimodal treatment, I mean treatment that addresses the full range of a patient's biopsychosocial challenges by providing a range of therapies for chronic pain. This means connecting patients with appropriate treatments. The VA recommends using a stepped care model for pain management. This entails first population-based screening, then assessment and management of chronic pain using a full range of low-intensity interventions delivered in primary care settings. Finally, more intensive treatments should be targeted to individuals with more complex chronic pain. Despite these recommendations, there's currently substantial variation in the availability and utilization of chronic pain treatment in the VA. The objectives of this study were to understand some of that variation and to understand the perspectives of healthcare providers and administrators on barriers and facilitators to multimodal chronic pain care. This study was also aimed at informing the development of an intervention to support multimodal chronic pain care in the VA, but that will not be the focus of this talk. So I'll talk a little bit about our methods. For sampling, we identified early and late adopting sites of multimodal chronic pain care. These sites were identified using an index that looks at the use of several different pain care modalities. We used purposive sampling at early and late adopting sites, and then snowball sampling within these sites to identify other key stakeholders who might have important information or interesting experiences with chronic pain care in the VA. For interviews and analysis, we created an interview guide designed to identify barriers and facilitators to multimodal chronic pain care. Our interview guide was informed by the Practical Robust Implementation and Sustainability Model, or PRISM. PRISM is an implementation model that considers several levels important to intervention planning. Here, the things that we were most interested in were institutional characteristics that might affect chronic pain care, so things like leadership support, the external environment, things like VA policies that might affect multimodal chronic pain care, and also patient characteristics. We conducted all of our interviews by phone. Interviews were audio recorded and transcribed verbatim. Interview transcripts were coded by a team using inductive and deductive conventional content analysis. We used a deductive code book based on PRISM and inductive coding to identify other interesting emergent factors. So for results, I'll first talk about our participants and then some of the themes that we identified in these interviews. The table on the left shows a summary of our interviews. We conducted 49 interviews with providers at 24 facilities. 7 of these were early adopting facilities, 9 were late adopting facilities, 12 VA medical centers, 7 urban CBOCs, and 5 rural CBOCs. The table on the right breaks down our participants a little more granularly. You can see that we talked to primarily doctors and nurses at these sites. However, we were able to talk to a number of people in other roles that provide chronic pain management. About half of our participants were women, and also about half were white. So now I'll dive into our themes. I'll talk about each of these in a little bit more detail in a moment. But the first was a temporal shift in pain management from managing pain to monitoring opioid use. The second was competing pressures on primary care teams from expert guidelines, VA policy, facility leadership, and veterans. The third, lack of time, education, and specialty care support for primary care. And finally, suggestions. This isn't really a theme, but our participants did give a number of very astute suggestions, and I wanted to touch on some of those here. So the first theme, a temporal shift in pain management from managing pain to monitoring opioid use. Several of our participants noted that it was once standard to prescribe opioids at very high doses. Some even noted that when they entered the VA, they were shocked at how ubiquitously opioids were prescribed. Now they're concerned that the focus of pain management has really become a focus on opioid management and monitoring rather than on actually treating pain. That said, in some cases, participants did feel that treatment has become more multimodal, especially at early adopting sites. This person said, when I started, we had quite a large number of patients who were on very large doses of opioids. The providers that we have now in the clinic have started to really attempt to wean down opioid use and augment it with physical therapy, pain management, acupuncture, any of the other modalities. So despite this focus on opioid monitoring, we do see some improvements in terms of multimodal treatment. Similarly, many of our participants do feel that the opioid problem is getting better within the VA. This person said that there's a huge amount of opioid use within the VA itself, and it has improved with some specific direction. I think that the larger amounts of morphine equivalents that when I showed up here 5.5 years ago are definitely improved and have decreased. So we see that things are getting better. providers at early adopting sites specifically mentioned several facilitators that have helped with this improvement in opioid prescribing and also in multimodal treatment. These facilitators included things like leadership support, knowledge of risk of long-term opioid use, clear recommendations for opioid prescribing. Some providers mentioned the role of pharmacy in helping with opioid tapering, pain management teams, and some people also mentioned programs like Scan Echo. Our next theme, competing pressures on primary care teams from expert guidelines, VA policy, facility leadership, and veterans. There were so many things that came up under this theme, and I'd like to touch on a few of them today. First of all, most people we talked to said that expert guidelines recommend reducing opioids, and that VA, national, and local leadership are very on board with doing this. However, some participants felt that leadership wanted to reduce opioid prescribing at all costs, despite patient desires or despite what some primary care providers feel is medically appropriate. This person said, "Well, basically, the way things are structured here is that it seems like the focus seems to be to eliminate narcotic medication at all costs, regardless of the patient's circumstances, as the sole focus." So this was a concern to some of the people that we talked to. Another pressure, and I find this one particularly interesting, is that some of our participants feel that VA leadership doesn't support its providers well enough in public arenas. For example, providers, despite their best efforts to connect veterans with the best care, whether this means tapering opioids or using other modalities, some veterans may be unhappy with the care that they're receiving. Maybe they want to continue taking opioids, or they don't feel that other modalities are working for them. They have the ability to complain very publicly, and so the VA then receives bad press, and some of these providers feel that they've received a slap on the wrist for doing things that are in line with recommendations. So this person says, "When any veteran can go to our local newspaper, any politician can go to our local news, and this has happened. Our local politician went to our local news and just trashed us, absolutely lied and trashed us, and it was all about narcotics. So I've always felt like the VA should stand up for the VA." So these providers feel that they're facing lots of pressures and still trying to provide the best treatment, and they feel that they need more support. In a similar vein, a couple of the people we talked to feared loss of job or even congressional action or congressional complaints, to the point that they actually felt anxious to care for patients in a way that they feel is appropriate. This person said of the VA, "They're so afraid, there's so much hostility that this problem will come. It's like a pendulum. Now we were doing fantastic, but the pendulum is now swinging the other way, and we're all afraid. How can we possibly give good patient care if we're afraid that our actions will result in our termination?" I thought this quote was particularly poignant because everybody we talked to was very concerned with making sure that they were serving veterans in the best way possible. So our final theme that I want to talk about is lack of time, education, and specialty care support for primary care teams. I think, first of all, I'd like to touch on limited resources, especially at late adopting sites. Participants noted a lack of specialty care, no pain management experts, no substance abuse treatment program, a lack of pharmacy involvement in opioid tapering. Some providers mentioned being in very rural areas where there were not enough providers to deal with the patient demands. So lots of challenges related to lack of resources. This person said, "That's where our biggest struggle is. We have very limited resources on site to assist us." And this is something that we heard from many of the late adopters that we talked to, that they're doing the best they can, but they really do need more support. A lack of education was also a common theme, both at early and late adopting sites. It was interesting. Most of the PCPs we talked to felt very comfortable with chronic pain management, but uncomfortable with opioid management. Most of them had very little training. In some cases, the only training providers had received was a TMS model on pain management, and almost all of the providers we talked to wanted more training. So this person, a psychologist at an early adopting site, said, said, I'm not sure what kind of training is available, but at this time, if there is more training available, and you know, I would like to equip myself with more knowledge and skills to help my patients better and help them with their pain. So I would welcome that kind of training. Providers also talked about a lack of time. In particular, they talked about a lack of time as a tension between the struggle to provide patient access and the struggle to provide proper pain management. So this person says, it's a process, and it's slow in coming. And nationally, they've got this quota where you have to have X amount of appointments. Appointments can be no longer than half an hour, so there's a lot of barriers to that. Many of the physicians we talked to said that half an hour simply isn't enough time to deal with very complex patients with chronic pain. So now I'd like to move on to some of the suggestions that we received to participants from participants. There were several, and I only chose a few to present here that I thought were maybe interesting or just very ubiquitous among our participants. The first one was public acknowledgement, and this one might not be something you think of, but several of the providers we talked to wanted the VA to more publicly acknowledge the opioid problem and to come up with a concrete VA policy on tapering. They felt that the VA providing recommendations didn't give them the support that they needed for difficult conversations with their patients. So this person says the VA should publicly address this issue, and that's not just someone saying we're going to deal with the opioid crisis. The next suggestion was information on the utilities of other modalities, so modalities other than opioids to support chronic pain. Providers felt that if they know how well things like physical therapy, chiropractor visits, maybe battlefield acupuncture, yoga actually work, they might be more likely to recommend those modalities to their patients, and they actually might be able to convince their patients to try these things. So this person says, if we are able to gather data from other measures, you know, alternative medicine that helps with pain management, I think that would be helpful. And we heard this from a lot of participants. Many of our participants also wanted more patient education. Several wanted to make it mandatory that patients have to go through a pain management school, either before being prescribed opioids or just in general if they're dealing with chronic pain. Other providers wanted to see more educational information, so more educational materials on evidence-based practices to deal with primary or with chronic pain. Participants also wanted more data on treatment modalities that patients actually use. Most of our participants felt that there was pretty good data and they were able to see where patients were getting prescriptions from. So they're able to see if patients are getting opioids outside of the VA, but they didn't have a good way to track whether patients are actually going to physical therapy or actually visiting the chiropractor. This person made a really good point. It would be nice to see who of the veterans that are suffering from chronic pain are utilizing the extra resources. And if they're not, be able to know that so we can work with them and see what we can do to make that happen, or maybe we need to try something else. And I thought this was a really nice point. If you don't know what your patients are doing, it's hard to know how to help them or what suggestions to make. And finally, I think this was a suggestion that we had overwhelmingly from participants at late adopting sites, but it was almost all of them. Participants wanted to see multidisciplinary pain teams. They thought that dedicated pain teams with multidisciplinary backgrounds would benefit patients, would help them make different treatment recommendations. A lot of them wanted more pharmacy involvement related to opioid tapering. And interestingly, at early adopting sites, people talked about pain teams as facilitators to multimodal chronic pain care. So this person says, we should have a dedicated pain specialist. There should be pain psychologists. We should have a well-developed substance abuse treatment program, and we don't. We just don't have the pain management team that we really should have when we're at the same time asking providers to reduce doses of opioids and, you know, be safer with them. So I think this comes back to that theme of limited support. A lot of these providers at late adopting sites had very limited resources and support in trying to do a very difficult job. So So in summary, first of all, I think it's interesting. Across the board, we didn't see very many differences between early and late adopters on most topics. The exception would be resources. Providers at early adopting sites had more resources, more leadership support related to multimodal chronic pain care. I think it's really interesting that most of our participants, and you see that in the themes that I just discussed, talked about opioid management and opioid tapering and not as much about multimodal pain care. Our interview guide asked specifically about multimodal pain care, about all of the treatment modalities that providers use, but again and again, interviews came back to opioids. And I think that this indicates that opioid reduction is a really salient issue. It's on the mind of a lot of providers, and it's maybe something that we need to provide more support for. In addition, we see many challenges related to pain management in primary care. These include large panel sizes, related to shorter appointment times, the accessibility of additional training. Many providers didn't even know what training was available. Leadership support or a lack of leadership support for multimodal pain care, so maybe leadership not being on board with providers having access to different modalities or providing enough information. A lack of pain management teams. I'll just repeat one more time that this came up in so many of our interviews. Almost all of the people we talked to at late adopting sites really wanted pain management teams or at least a pain specialist. And finally, veteran education on opioid safety. Providers felt that more educational materials, maybe mandatory education, would help them deal with patients and help their patients come to some of these difficult conversations with better information. So in summary, more support, more data, and more training would be helpful for chronic pain management in primary care. There are a couple of limitations I want to touch on. First of all, this is a qualitative study, so we don't know how generalizable our results are. We suspect that they're pretty generalizable within the VA, but may not be applicable outside of the VA. We also had some sampling issues. We had a very low response rate at most of the sites that we contacted, so it was actually difficult to get those 49 interviews. As you saw, we talked mostly to doctors and nurses, not as much to other types of providers who deal with chronic pain. And the implications of this study. First of all, primary care providers face several pressures. This makes it harder for them to do an already very difficult job in chronic pain management. And any efforts to improve chronic pain management or an intervention to improve multimodal chronic pain care in the VA needs to address both organizational and patient-level challenges. So organizational challenges include things like panel sizes or a lack of resources or lack of education for providers. And patient-level challenges would include things like patient understanding or, as we heard from some participants, just a stricter policy so that patients understand where the VA stands on opioid use. And I just want to thank Dr. Joseph Frank, the PI of this project, and the rest of our study team, as well as our operations partners and Query for funding this research. So thank you all for listening, and I guess we're ready for questions.
Thank you. These were terrific presentations. If people have some questions specific to these talks, that would be really helpful to send in. Maybe I can ask Dr. Bob Kearns to say some words and reflect on these presentations first.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sounds good.
Yes. Oh, great. Okay. So I agree. Great presentations. You know, I'm a fan of both of these projects. I really tee up the question that I think I would ask, I guess, Chelsea mostly to reflect on, but maybe Evan as well, about really what do you see as some of the important policy implications of these findings or practice initiatives. If Friedhelm was on, I'd ask him directly, but I think maybe what kind of feedback have you gotten from your operation or patient care services partners about where to take these study findings?
I think that in terms of what we heard from providers, policy implications would first and foremost just be having a clearer policy. In terms of where to take that finding, I don't know if I'm the best person to speak to that with regards to this study. I don't know, Evan, if you have anything to add to that.
Sure, yeah, this is Evan. I have some general thoughts about that. I think there's a couple of policy implications about it, and I think the two studies' results kind of dovetail nicely together in terms of what should we expect the future veteran needs to look like in the near term and maybe 5 years out, and then what sort of resources do we need in place to provide high-quality care to veterans. And I think we also have to recognize the current maybe status and fabric of pressure to decrease opioid exposure, therapy exposure, but maybe not always replacement therapy being available or providers not always knowing exactly what other things to offer. I think from a policy perspective, we have to consider increasing training opportunities for primary care providers, as they are the lion's share of the responsibility of taking care of veterans, complex veterans with chronic pain conditions, falls on primary care providers that may not all feel adequately equipped or trained to take care of them. And so I think it's partially training, and we have some initiatives in the VA, Scan Echo, and then some other technology-assisted initiatives. I guess it's Echo now these days, but other initiatives where we try to train primary care providers via specialists in remote locations. But I think another issue is all the training in the world for a primary care provider doesn't do any good if they don't have a physical therapist to refer their patient to, right, if the resources aren't in place otherwise. So I think that's some of the policy implications, and a lot of it's around developing resources. I think really just in the recent times with the ramp-up of the CHOICE program and maybe the future increase of non-VA care, that we have to really consider what types of veterans are going to be challenging for our community care providers to take care of, and how we might need to similarly equip community care providers and have some coordination of which veterans go out to care, and that sort of thing. I don't know if you have any follow-up thoughts, Bob.
No, I think that's great. Maybe a more specific question to Chelsea is, you know, a lot of the feedback that emerged or the themes that emerged, maybe this is an overgeneralization, but it looked like there were a lot of, barriers, overshadowed facilitators. What would you say was learned from the qualitative interviews of the providers and you know, the other stakeholders with regard to what they, besides more resources or, you know, some way of promoting equitable access to non-opioid therapies, did you get any more specific recommendations about what they, what they think is working that could be expanded, or what else? It's easy to say we need more resources, but you know, that can't always be the case, especially, for example, in rural CBOCs. I don't think there's a likelihood of building up physical therapy and psychology and all these other interventions in these, smaller CBOCs.
So
what other ideas do they have?
Yeah, can I just build on what you're saying, Bob? Because I was thinking how much I liked some of the recommendations, things like maybe making pain school mandatory. I know that might involve resources, but perhaps there's a way of doing that web-based or group-based. I thought that was really interesting, and my mind was kind of going in the direction of how might you do that. And the other suggestion that I thought was, you know, really something I had never thought of before, but this idea that we can track, you know, people's prescriptions and, you know, what they're filling, but do we have a way of tracking things like PT or chiropractic or acupuncture? And how cool would that be to be able to have a system to do that? So maybe you have more specific thoughts on some of those recommendations.
Okay, definitely. Thanks. So I'll start with other ideas or other suggestions that came from some of the providers that we talked to. I think that you're right, Bob, that it is very easy to say we need more resources. I'm thinking of one interview in particular with an MD at an early adopting site who had taken over the pain program at that site recently, and she or this person talked pretty explicitly about how important leadership involvement is. When she took on this position, was very focused on reducing opioids and also on educating providers within that team on other ways to treat pain, and found that leadership was very on board with this after explaining all of the reasons that you would want to do this and all of the ways that you could do this. So I think leadership involvement is a pretty important suggestion. We actually asked in our interviews about Scan Echo and whether or not people felt that Scan Echo would be useful, a useful resource in managing chronic pain for more difficult patients. Most of the people that we talked to thought that that was a great idea, with the caveat that they don't have time to call into programs like Scan Echo because their panel sizes were so large. So a lot of people said if they had protected time that they would absolutely participate in something like Scan Echo, and they thought that would be a great resource. With regards to a pain school for veterans, I think it is a really interesting idea. Some sites did have pain schools. Providers mentioned that veterans were more likely to attend if they were offered on weekends, so times when they weren't working, so they could make it to those pain classes. At one site, it was kind of an innovative solution. This was a rural site, and they had a pain lead. And this was a nurse with expertise in pain care who traveled around the region, providing education both to providers and patients on pain management. So I thought that was a really neat solution in a pretty large geographic area, also I'll mention. In terms of tracking, I have no idea if we have a way to track the use of other modalities, but I think it's a great idea. It seems like something that we should be able to do if we're able to track prescriptions, but I'm not really sure how feasible that is.
I'm not sure if I can be heard now. This is Frieda.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Hi, wonderful. You know, I've been trying to come in. So thank you, first of all, Evan and Chelsea, for really presenting wonderful data. And as Bob already explained, I mean, lots of what you're describing really has implications on what we're doing. In many ways, though, I want to emphasize we've been addressing some of these issues that you bring up. For instance, you know, we've mandated pain medicine teams, interdisciplinary teams, at all facilities. Now, this mandate came only out last summer, so certainly some sites are clearly behind in implementing these interdisciplinary pain teams. But, you know, I think we are in a process there, and as you pointed out, the concerns about resources there. The PACT pain roadmap also, that was just finished in its second update, clearly articulates the need to support primary care with timely access to integrative health, with timely access to pain specialty and, you know, access to addiction therapy in primary care. So I think there is a realization about what needs to be done, at least at the policy, or at least at the, you know, program office, I should say. But at the same time, it is, you know, we are competing for resources, right? And I think that's where we need to reach facility leaders who makes a decision about the resources. And this is why Evan's data and, you know, your data is going to be so important for us to articulate, I think, through the National Pain Program and through Central Office as we communicate with resident facility leaders who control the resources and who make decisions about what programs, you know, receive funding support. So I'm incredibly grateful for this. And the sooner I can see this in writing, I think the sooner it will help us to you know, continue to make our arguments in this regard.
Uh, We have one person who also wrote in a question about being able to expand and prioritizing things like physical therapy, even at the C-Box, to, you know, just expand those types of services or things like tele-rehabilitation. I don't know if anybody can speak to those things.
I could briefly say that we did talk to some people in rural areas who mentioned community resources, so they could use community physical therapy, things like that. A lot of people mentioned telehealth. I think that telehealth was useful for some modalities more so than others, but it was certainly on the radar of a lot of the providers we talked to.
Any other last questions or comments from our panel?
Well, I'll just mention I can see a lot of the chat going on, and you know, it is important that we really think about not just what are the problems and keep reiterating or providing more data about some of the barriers, but we do focus on these policy initiatives and solutions, as Freedom has just mentioned, and maybe others. I think, you know, these challenges are huge, but one that I think is highlighted here is really access to multimodal care. It seems important to keep trying to strengthen or enhance access through a variety of needs, but particularly challenging, I think, is the issue of meeting the needs of veterans who are receiving most of their care in rural and generally disadvantaged communities and settings. And I think, you know, I'm aware that there's a lot of movement in the direction of, in the areas of active interventions that promote adaptive pain self-management. Use of technology is, I think, to be highlighted, and we've heard a lot about that, I think, maybe on future calls. We want to keep bringing that up. And then the issue is, having built some of these tools and resources, how do we integrate them into the workflow in busy primary care and PAC team settings? You know, I think there's more and more of these tools and resources available, but they're yet to find their way into the mainstream of practice. So anyway, I'll just add my thanks to Evan and Chelsea for great presentations. I think this is really important work.
Yes,
yeah, and this
thank
is Freedom.
You.
Yeah, I want to thank you also the presenters, but I also want to thank Bob Kearns and, you know, others in the National Pain Program who've really, I think we've made great progress in the last years, right? Since our National Pain Directive came out in 2009, I think we've, you know, you've done incredible work, Bob, and I think we need to make sure that this access is now across the system, not just as the highest performing side. And I think that's something that has reflected the need to bring this care everywhere.
Thank you. Thank you so much to our speakers. This was really wonderful data in terms of the trends and the barriers and facilitators in terms of what's going on with pain and pain care in the VA. Thank you to our panelists. Dr. Friedhelm Sandbrink and Dr. Bob Kearns. Thank you for our audience for participating and writing in with some great questions that made for an interesting discussion. Just hold on for one more minute and you will see a short feedback form that will pop up. If anyone is interested in downloading the PowerPoint slides from today, please go to the reminder email you received this morning, and you'll be able to find the link to the presentation. If you're interested in downloading slides from any of our past sessions, everything is archived. Simply do an internet search on VA Cyber Seminars Archive, and you can use the filters to find our previous seminars. You'll also be receiving an email with your certificate of attendance for today's session. Please stay tuned for our next cyber seminar, which will be on Tuesday, May 1st, by Dr. Mary Driscoll. We'll be sending registration information out around the 15th of the month. And I want to thank everyone for attending this HSR&D cyber seminar, and we hope that you'll join us again.